Good morning, Green Bay Packers fans. Welcome to Railbird Central at Cheesehead TV. I'm your host, Brian Caravu. Joined this morning by our live blog director, Jamie Jors. We're talking some Packers football. We're getting ready for the NFL draft now, just 2 days away. To do that, for our NFL draft preview episode of Railbird Central, we have a guest joining us on the phone this morning to kick off the show. We have Paul Basir of PredictionMachine.com. Paul, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
Very good. I love having you on the show, Paul. You at PredictionMachine.com, you're not afraid to do some outside-the-box thinking. I know personally that you had ranked Casey Hayward, Packers cornerback Casey Hayward, the number one cornerback in the draft last year, which I think is really unique. I don't think many people had him that high, although maybe they had him in their top five or something like that. But can you talk a little bit about what goes into your rankings and how you do them and how you come up with a guy like Casey Hayward?
Well, the mantra that we have at PredictionMachine.com is that we play the game 50,000 times before it's actually played. While we're not technically playing the draft here 50,000 times before the draft actually starts, the same numbers and analysis and objective approach that I have to take to try to evaluate players and what their impact is going to be going into every football season, and I've done this for 10 previous NFL years, had to project, you know, not just fantasy stats, but what if we think every team's going to do, that same approach that I have to take to translate a college player's statistics and measurables to what it's going to look like in the NFL, we've taken a look at and evaluated before the draft to see which players are the best players overall, using completely, you know, strictly data-driven, if you will, analytics view. Those are buzzwords right now, but just what the numbers say. And if you can play at the collegiate level and perform well on the field, really regardless of level, oftentimes you can play pretty well at the NFL level once you get on the field, and it's more important even to look at the other way around. If you can't play, and if you've consistently shown an inability to be productive at the collegiate level, it is very difficult for prospects along those lines, and there's plenty of them, quote-unquote, moving up draft boards this year that are showing up high up on draft boards that never really did anything at the collegiate level. Those are usually the ones that don't do well at the NFL. So I'm looking strictly at what they've done, checking boxes when it comes to the combine and size and fit and things along those lines to evaluate how good players truly are. I'm producing what we've come up with, rankings and projections for every single player, over 600 possible drafted players. And even a mock draft, not really what we expect to happen by any means, but what we think should happen if every play, if every team takes the best and most important and best fit available at every given spot.
So is there any subjectivity involved in your rankings at all, or is it strictly statistical measures and objectivity that goes into it?
I mean, inherently, any objective analysis has, like, along these lines, where you're projecting forward, as some element of subjectivity into what I've found to be important. It's as objective as possible is the way I like to phrase it. And there's some positions, certainly offensive line is a very difficult position to really nail down. And even when it comes to defensive lineman positions or things along those lines, tight end, when it comes to blocking, those type of positions, sometimes we need to take a bigger, broader view and look more at what the team has done with than what just the player has done and try to evaluate what the player's impact might have been along those lines. So there's some element to that. Matt Richner, who's a colleague of mine who has worked for about 8 teams in the NFL doing similar analysis and looking at really the data to figure out which players or at least which benchmarks each player should have at each position, evaluates a lot more film than maybe I do. We do include that into our rankings as well just to make sure it's, again, being able to play football, which I think sounds very obvious, but is the most important thing I'm trying to evaluate here, that's all objective in terms of what we're trying to figure out. After that, it's checking boxes. Does the film, do the measurables, do the combine numbers also indicate that this player should be able to play football at the NFL level? But when it comes down to it, what you've done on the field is what I'm most concerned about.
Before I ask you about a couple players in this year's NFL draft, I just, you know, you hit on a guy like Casey Hayward, but then because you do a little bit of outside-the-box thinking here, I think you do make some projections that, you know, a lot of other people don't make. And, you know, I just went back prior to this interview and looked at last year's. You had Jerry Franklin of Arkansas as your number two inside linebacker. You had Winston Guy as your number two safety last year. You know, I could make the argument, well, be like, well, you know, obviously, you know, I wouldn't have had those guys up there. You know, how do you justify that, and how do those guys get up so high?
Well, I think Jerry Franklin was incredibly productive at Arkansas and really could still be a decent pro. He wasn't drafted, so that does look a little bit odd. That being said, there was nobody outside of the, you know, we had number one overall inside linebacker got a significant grade. I think like almost boutiquely got a grade of 9.5 in my numbers on a scale of 0 to 10, which is the highest I think I've seen in inside linebacker in about the 4 or 5 years that I've had this grading system, whereas Jerry Franklin was like a 7.2. So there's a huge gap between them, and everybody else, including Bobby Wagner, was pretty much in that mix. And you'll see some guys jump out from that and some guys that won't. Productivity is what my concern is. If Jerry Franklin did it at Arkansas at a high level, had over 100 tackles two consecutive seasons in the SEC, and I think could be a decent pro. He's actually, I believe, either on the practice squad or at the very least on the roster going into the season for the Chicago Bears. And it could be somebody the Packers fans ultimately learn a little bit more about. Winston Guy dealt with injuries as a rookie safety in his first year, and I think could step up and do some things going forward too. And in some, you know, there are going to be there's an element of probability here. I understand that better than anybody else. And so what I'm looking for is the players that are most likely to profile into future NFL starters. It doesn't necessarily mean in year one, but hopefully in the future, it still means that they can do something.
Well, let's talk about a couple of guys in this year's NFL draft. A couple guys who I think you have higher than most NFL draft prognosticators, and maybe why these guys stick out. Safety is a position of need for the Packers. You have Philip Thomas of Fresno State as your number one safety. I mean, I see him ranked out there, but not that high as anybody else. So what do you like about Philip Thomas? What does he bring to the table?
Yeah, we've got him 18th overall in my top 250 rankings when you evaluate all prospects. He's about as good as Harrison Smith was going into last year's draft, but he would have been the next best, and then actually then better than Winston Guy in terms of the numbers for comparison purposes. You know, 6'1", 215 pounds. He's physically, he's right there. I think it's a two-safety draft, basically, than everybody else. So Thomas and Matty Ioannemi being more the strong safety, Thomas being the true free safety and the best free safety in this draft, somebody I'm sure the Packers would love to have at some point, is a playmaker. The issue with him isn't necessarily that he wasn't that productive or even that he doesn't look that good on film. The issue is that he missed all of 2011 with an injury, and so there are durability concerns, because coming out in 2010, he looked like a tremendous NFL prospect, disappeared because of the injury, and actually had a more productive 2012 than 2010. Averaged 2.2 impact plays per game, so we're looking at tackles for loss, sacks, interceptions and pass breakups is what the way that safeties can truly impact the game. And that's unbelievable. That number is, from a safety position, is basically off the charts when it comes to what we can see. And yeah, interceptions can be fluky, but when you've also got all the other numbers to back them up, Philip Thomas is the kind of guy that I think could step right in and not just be a solid pro, but be a guy who actually makes plays. There haven't been that many safeties that you can consistently count on doing that. We could name them basically and probably count them in on one hand. What we've seen recently, I think Thomas profiles to a guy who could be like that.
At wide receiver, kind of like Philip Thomas, you've got Terrence Williams of Baylor as your number one wide receiver. And again, a guy I see people ranked fairly high, but not as high as number one. What do you like about Terrence Williams?
Yeah, and actually very similarly to safety, wide receiver's a two-person draft, really, and then everybody else. We've got Terrence Williams and Tavon Austin as two clear best players at that position, and one of them is more the outside guy with Terrence Williams, one of them is more the slot guy like Tavon Austin, and Williams actually gets the better grade. And Williams would have been the best receiver in either of the last two draft classes, according to us, and actually the top 10 overall prospect. I'm not sure why people don't like him. I can figure it out with Thomas because it's more durability. With Baylor, I understand that oftentimes the scheme and the system inflates numbers, but when you look at what Kendall Wright did with RG3 2 years ago, as opposed to what Terrence Williams did with Nick Florence and that Baylor offense this year, Williams was a good prospect, has better size, is faster than Kendall Wright, and was more productive than Kendall Wright. To me, at least, at the very least, he's a slam dunk in terms of being a better potential prospect than that. Number 7 overall on my board, 6201. He's played 43 career games, and ranks in the top 10 overall in both receptions in his career and receiving yards in his career amongst this year's draft class, and still has over 16 yards per reception. Again, I get the offensive scheme. I get that the Big 12 pass defenses aren't that good, or at least we don't consider them that good. But it's still pretty good competition. It's about as high a competition level as you can get to consistently put up pretty big numbers there. He's the only guy of this year's draft class that, as of right now, we would profile as being a 1,000-plus yard receiver on an average NFL team in 2013.
Interesting. At quarterback, you have Landry Jones as your number two QB overall. And, you know, I see guys like Matt Barkley, Ryan Nassib, EJ Manuel, usually, and, you know, when you go around the internet, look at magazines, have them rated higher. The Packers could use a backup quarterback to Aaron Rodgers, perhaps. What's Landry Jones got?
And I certainly think that the Packers should take a backup quarterback in this year's draft. They don't have the size of the draft class is maybe a Seattle or San Francisco that is picking later in the rounds and probably could use a guy to stash away, but I think they still want to go that route. When we did our mock draft, I picked one. If Landry Jones is still around in the fourth or fifth round or so, I certainly think that's the guy to target because to us, he's the number two overall quarterback. Now, that being said, he's not even a top 35 overall pick, so I wouldn't consider him a first rounder this year's draft class from quarterbacks. It's very different than last year's. Everybody's saying that, but he would have been, Landry Jones, despite being second on our board for this year's quarterback class, would have been seventh last year, so there's certainly a difference there. But I don't understand really the issues with this. I think that Landry Jones actually stuck around so long that scouts are so focused on his weaknesses and on looking for the next big thing elsewhere that they've been realizing that he's consistently been a very good quarterback at Oklahoma, again, playing at a high level in the Big 12 there. And in our evaluations, you know, because of what he's done, because he's never missed a game, he's got 50 starts, and he's consistently put up really good numbers against elite competition, though there are some very obvious mistakes he's made in big games, he still evaluates as just one-tenth of a point lower than Sam Bradford. I'm not saying that I think either of those quarterbacks, Landry Jones or Sam Bradford, is ever going to be an above-average NFL quarterback, but if Bradford can go number one overall, Andrew Jones certainly deserves to be somewhere in the second to third round conversation at the very least based on what he's been able to do. I'm not the first person who said this by any means, but from a mobility standpoint, obviously he has none of that. People are looking for that right now, and I think that's elevating Geno Smith, EJ Manuel, and others. Even Ryan Nassib is a little bit more mobile when it comes to what he can do moving around outside the pocket. Landry Jones isn't that guy, but his ceiling still looks like it could be Kurt Warner, and that's not a bad position to be in because he can make every throw. And in this case, unlike what Warner did with Northern Iowa, Jones has shown it consistently for four seasons at the highest possible level that he could, that he's a good quarterback.
Over on the defensive side of the football, Tank Carradine, a guy who's pretty high on most everybody's draft boards, you got him as your number two defensive end. I guess, you know, kind of just wondering, I don't think he falls to the Packers, but, you know, where does this guy fit? Is he a 4-3 defensive end? Is he a 3-4 outside linebacker? Can he do that? And what's his ceiling in the NFL?
I think he's a defensive end. Profile and his, you know, physicality wise and his combat numbers and what he did in college, I think he can play defensive end. He's got the speed though, assuming that he's able to bounce back here from the ACL injury, and what we've seen based on what he did in his 40 or what he did at his pro day here recently, it looks like he could be able to pull that off. He could be an outside linebacker, but at 276, he's not necessarily the guy that you're looking for here. But with Tank Carradine and actually Cooper Taylor, a safety that if the Packers get in the later rounds, I will freak out about because of whatever everything is able to do. Those are the two most intriguing players to me in this entire draft. Tank Carradine at 6'5", 205, coming out of high school, was strongly recruited as a linebacker coming out of Taft High School in Cincinnati, but couldn't qualify academically. 2 years dominating junior college football, and dominating is important because you have to do that at JUCO level in order for us to start paying attention to you. He added 70 pounds over the course of two seasons, put up phenomenal per-snap numbers behind Bjorn Werner and Brandon Jenkins at Florida State last year, at least in 2011, while still playing behind those two. And then when he got his chance to start when Jenkins got injured, Carradine absolutely dominated in every possible way the defensive lineman can, leading his team in tackles, picking up sacks, then ultimately through the Florida game in 2012, then towards ACL. It's 135 days, or now I think it's about 138 days since that injury, and yet he can still run a 4.7 40 at 6'5", 276. Carrying the top five overall prospect on my board, if he can get and stay healthy, he can be a very good pro. And to me, similar measurables to what Ziggy Ansah did and has coming out of BYU in terms of speed, size, length, strength, all of those things. Yes, there's the injury concern, but Carradine was far more productive on the field than Ziggy Ansah, and I think certainly deserves to go well ahead of him when it comes to draft day.
Paul, before we let you go, I want to talk to you about one last guy here, sure. Kind of one of those ones that I think is really under the radar that I don't think many people have even heard of, an inside linebacker, Dan Moles of Toledo. You've got him as your number three inside linebacker. There might not be many people of him in their top 20. Who's Dan Moles and why is he so good?
Dan Moles has almost identical numbers to Manti Te'a. Now, they play two different levels of competition, but it's interesting to see at the inside linebacker position. And for what it's worth, this is essentially my Jerry Franklin of this year's inside linebacker draft class. So put it in things into comparison when it comes to that. He might not be a guy who is highly drafted or makes a roster early, and he is only 6'2", 223, which is almost identical to what Jerry Franklin's numbers were. But in terms of what he's been able to do on the field in the MAC, consistently being, and that's again, proving consistently that he can be a playmaker and a guy that can do his job. Toledo didn't have the greatest defense, but he was definitely the best player on that defense year in and year out. We have him as actually the number 27th overall player, period, third inside linebacker, essentially tied with Kevin Minter and Kevin Reddick from LSU and UNC are basically getting a little bit more attention right now. He was number one player in all of college football in terms of tackles in 2012, and number one among all inside linebackers in both interceptions and forced fumbles. Interceptions is actually an odd statistic that translates into performance, stronger performance at the inside linebacker position in the NFL. Part of that's because coverage is becoming more and more important from the linebacker position in the NFL, and part of that's because that player needs to be, especially if he's got the tackle numbers as well, having a nose for the football is certainly important. Being able to find the football before anybody else does at that level is something that is continuously talked about as it relates to Manti Te'o. Well, Dan Moles was also a guy that could do that as well, and just as well as Manti Te'o. To me, the numbers are almost identical between those two players. I don't think there's that much that separates them, save for a little bit of size. Obviously, Manti Te'o is got about 20 pounds on him, and obviously the level of competition. But Moles as a prospect looks like he's pretty solid as well.
Very interesting. Well, Paul, we appreciate you joining us here this morning at Cheesehead TV, just 2 days away from the draft. You're a wealth of knowledge, and I learn a lot from talking to you.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. Paul Basir of PredictionMachine.com joining us here on Cheesehead TV. Thanks to him, and thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in on our NFL Draft Preview Show, an atypical Tuesday morning. I apologize. We didn't have a show on Monday morning. Had some family issues come up that just couldn't be avoided. But what we're doing here this week, we have our NFL Draft Preview episode today, and then that's it. But we're not going to do our regular Wednesday, Friday, but what we're going to do is starting Thursday, it's special editions of Railbird Central all throughout the NFL draft. So, if you've been with us in previous years, we've done the same thing. So on Thursday night, right after the Packers make their first pick, or perhaps if they make a trade right after their trade, whatever it is they're doing, we're going to come here, break it down, see what the Packers are doing. If they take a player, we're going to break him down, look at where he fits into the Packers' scheme, systems, what have you. So, and same thing, after every pick, or at least after every round, we're going to come on air here at Cheesehead TV. We're going to have the homepage taken over like it usually is when we broadcast a live show. So make sure to come here all draft long for your Packers NFL draft needs. And we're going to have interviews and we're going to have articles and you name it. This can be literally your one-stop destination. I hope you make it that. So Thursday, Friday, Saturday, kind of nonstop coverage, just shows on and off after every pick. So Kevin Lamb asks, will the chat be open during the entire draft? Yes, it will. So we'll have live blogs going on throughout the whole entire draft. We'll be using the old Cover It Live format like we do for games here at Cheesehead TV. So, we'll be doing that, so make sure to check that out. You know, just kind of continuing, though, our discussion here this morning of Packers news at Cheesehead TV. And there's one item I really wanted to get to today that's not exactly NFL draft related here this morning, but, you know, having to do with the Green Bay Packers. And that has to do with tight end JerMichael Finley. As you may have seen around the blogosphere this past weekend, JerMichael Finley kind of made headlines. And the only place you really saw this was in the national blogs like Deadspin and The Big Lead. And because, I mean, if you haven't seen the articles, and by all means, if somebody wants to provide a link to these articles at Deadspin or anything like that on our live blog, feel free there if you want to. You know, this woman, I don't know who she is. She's just apparently an acquaintance of JerMichael Finley, went off on Finley in social media. She, you know, making all sorts of claims and accusations and blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't pretty. I mean, it was rather an ugly exchange, or, you know, just going off on the guy on Twitter. And, you know, saying lots of nasty things about JerMichael Finley. And really, what it boils down to is she's accusing JerMichael Finley of not paying child support. As Deadspin and I believe other people have pointed out, that JerMichael Finley, through court records, it's you know, there's court proven records that JerMichael Finley has had a child out of wedlock. That's not, you know, really the court records online, you can see, prove that. But what is not proven is that JerMichael Finley has ever not paid child support. You know, there's really nothing to see here. There's nothing to report. You know, last I heard, having a child out of wedlock isn't a crime. So, you know, JerMichael Finley, from all we can tell, he's paid his child support, whatever. And as long as he continues to do so, you're not going to see any news outlets reporting on this. You're not going to see television stations or newspapers reporting this, because he's basically complying with the law. Now, that's not to say things can't change by tomorrow. All of a sudden, he could be convicted, or you know, a judge could rule that he hasn't been paying child support, whatever. But, I mean, that's merely speculation. So, you know, there's really nothing to see here, nothing to do here. As long as JerMichael Finley complies with the law, and there's no proof to say that he hasn't yet, you know, it's a moot point. And you know, I just, you know, I wanted to clarify that. I wanted to throw that out there, because there was a lot of national attention on JerMichael Finley. Say what you will about the guy, I don't think JerMichael Finley is a very smart guy. Just based upon what he says in his interviews and things like that. I personally would not be a friend of JerMichael Finley's if I had the opportunity, which we don't run in the same circles, so I'm not really too concerned about that. So, I mean, to some extent, you know, would it surprise me if JerMichael Finley got caught in a situation like this? No, it wouldn't. But, you know, and as long as he stays, you know, doesn't break any laws, you know, it's basically, I don't think you're going to see a whole lot more about this. So he's under his last year under contract in Green Bay. I've said this before. And this has nothing to do with the most recent, attention-getting escapades here. I think this is JerMichael Finley's last season in Green Bay. I literally cannot see him spending beyond 2013 in Green Bay. I don't know how it happens. Simply because he's a free agent. I think he's going to want to test free agency. Number two, I think the Packers have a lot of money tied up into Aaron Rodgers, Clay Matthews. So I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of money left over to sign Finley. Not only that, there's other guys whose contracts are coming up as well after this season. We're talking guys like James Jones, B.J. Raji, potentially Sam Shields, Morgan Burnett, a bunch of defensive linemen, Ryan Pickett, Mike Neal, C.J. Wilson. As we saw, there's five defensive linemen whose contracts are expiring after the 2013 season. Not all of them are high-level guys, but there's not going to be enough money to sign everyone. Some of these guys are going to depart after next season, and I think JerMichael Finley's a real likely candidate to be one of them. Whether the Packers address tight end in this year's draft is another question. I think it could very likely be the case that they do. Until the draft unfolds, we don't really know. I've said this before. If Tyler Eifert is available when the Packers are on the clock with the 26th pick in the first round, it's going to be really hard for them to pass that guy up. First of all, because I think he's the top tight end in this year's draft class. You also look at the situation, like he's probably perhaps your number two tight end in 2013, just because he's a little bit inexperienced. He'll play behind Finley for the most part, but still, a guy like Tyler Eifert would still get playing time. He would still be a target for Aaron Rodgers. And then in 2014, he's your number one guy. He's your number one tight end and hopefully a very productive one. And I think he can be a very productive one, especially in an offense like the Green Bay Packers with Aaron Rodgers as his quarterback. So that's how I feel about that. I don't think JerMichael Finley's long for Green Bay. In fact, I've even thrown this out before. Just assuming the Packers draft Tyler Eifert, I could see JerMichael Finley as one of those mid-season trade candidates that don't really happen that often in the NFL. But with a guy like him, I think they possibly could. But again, that's a conversation for a later date, probably, rather than right now. But it'll be interesting to see when and where the Packers address tight end in the NFL draft, if they do at all. The Packers do have a lot of depth at tight end. There's a lot of guys there, apart from JerMichael Finley, but also a lot of question marks. I think people have been waiting and continue to wait for DJ Williams to maybe do something. I don't know if they're waiting in vain or not. He's a guy who has 9 career receptions in 2 years. Waiting on DJ Williams, you might just be continuing to wait. I'm not sure he's got the size to be a big part of the Packers offense at tight end, at least maybe, Beep asked, what is Finley's trade value in draft picks? Well, I'll tell you what, the Packers aren't trading him in this NFL draft because they just paid him a $3 million roster bonus just weeks ago. What was it? 3 weeks ago. They just paid him $3 million. They're going to get that $3 million out of him. He's going to start the year with the Packers. He's going to be on the roster, guaranteed until midseason, when I think they might consider trading him before the deadline, perhaps. Even that is far-fetched. So they're going to get their worth out of him. But what you might see is JerMichael Finley leave via free agency, next year, and then they kind of maybe get a compensatory draft pick or something like that. And also, what our own Zach Cruz looked at in an article a week or two ago, placing the franchise tag on JerMichael Finley is highly, highly unlikely next year, because he has a salary around $8.5 million this year, and like there are certain minimums for the franchise tag that you have to be paid a certain percentage, like what is it, 110% of this year's salary, which would push it past almost every tight end in the NFL. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen with JerMichael Finley and the franchise tag, at least. So you can bet on that. So that's why I don't think he's going to be around beyond 2013. Although he'll be here 2013 for sure. They didn't pay him $3 million for nothing. They're going to expect to get some production out of this year, out of him. And hopefully get as much mileage as they can before he departs. And that's good for everyone, really. I mean, JerMichael Finley wants to have a good year, so he gets paid in free agency next year. The more he gets paid, the Packers, the better they can get in compensatory draft choices, things like that. So, there's a lot to like from all perspectives. For him having a good season, let alone that just, if he has a good season, hopefully the Packers do well as well, in terms of making their way through the playoffs and hopefully a Super Bowl. So that's that. I could definitely see, even if the Packers don't get a guy like Tyler Eifert in the first round, I could see him go in this, grab a guy in the second round. You're looking at guys like Zach Ertz of Stanford, who I am really high on. I think he is a good player. A lot of people think he's like a second round tight end. It wouldn't surprise me even if he goes in the first. I like him a lot. I think there's a lot to like there. But guys like Travis Kelce of Cincinnati, Vance McDonald of Rice, these are all day two tight ends and perhaps targets of the Green Bay Packers. Kelce with Cincinnati, he's got some off-the-field issues, character issues as well. I'm not sure he's going to be quite as high on the Packers' wish list as a guy who, with potential character concerns, replacing one potential character concern with another in terms of replacing Finley with Kelce. You're just trading one headache for another, potentially. Again, we should give these guys a chance, perhaps. Especially with a guy like Kelce, whose issues came earlier in his college career, and certainly should be given every opportunity to prove he has matured and shows he's now older and wiser for his previous transgressions. So, but anyway, the tight end position is fascinating this year, and it's a good crop of tight ends. So Packers can get a mid-round guy and perhaps even develop them and see what they've got. So it could be a position the Packers address at any point, high, middle, low in the draft, and still find good guys. Even in the later rounds, I like Joseph Fauria of UCLA. He led all tight ends in touchdowns last year in the NCAA. He's kind of predicted to be a late-round draft choice, the number one touchdown tight end in the NCAA last year. How does the number one touchdown production guy go so late? So great year for tight ends. You could find a good one late. But, it's past 9 o'clock here. That's going to do it for a Tuesday morning edition of Railbird Central here, folks. Thank you so much for joining us here at Cheesehead TV. Like I said, join us during the NFL draft. We're going to be broadcasting after every pick. We're going to have the live blog going on. We're going to have articles, you name it, all sorts of coverage. So we'll see you back here on Thursday. That'll be the next time I broadcast, is Thursday. So we'll see you then. On behalf of Jamie Jors, I'm Brian Caravu. Today, I leave you with a song called Bali Munster by String Cheese Incident on Psy Fidelity Records. We'll see you later, everyone. Go, Pack, go.